feeling unneeded, decided to see what lay off to the north and west. With six others, he set a course across the Great Basin toward Great Salt Lake. The landscape was more desolate than anything they had seen. If the Great American Desert was on the other side of the mountains, then what would you call this? Game was pitifully scarce. The herds of buffalo had vanished, and the only creatures appearing in numbers were rattlesnakes and jackrabbits. The few human beings encountered were numbingly primitive. They built no lodges, used the crudest tools, made no art. They subsisted, from all appearances, on roots and insects. A live gecko made a fine repast. Mark Twain, encountering some of the last of the wild Digger Indians half a century later, called them the wretchedest type of mankind I have ever seen. But they were, as Twain noted, merely a reflection of the landscape they found themselves in. Smith's party skirted Great Salt Lake and continued westward, becoming the first whites, and probably the first humans, to cross the Bonneville Salt Flats, 100 miles of horrifyingly barren terrain. Then they struck across what is now eastern Oregon, eventually reaching a British fort near the Columbia River. Sensing something less than a generous welcome, the British still wanted at least a piece of the subcontinent, the party turned around and was back on the Green River by July of 1825, in time for the trappers' first rendezvous. The rendezvous was the first all-male ritual in the non-Indian West, a kind of Baghdad bazaar leavened by fighting, fornication, and adventure stories that would have seemed outlandish if they hadn't, for the most part, been true. Trappers arrived from hundreds of miles around with their pelts, which they traded for whiskey sold by St. Louis entrepreneurs at $25 a gallon, for ammunition, and for staples such as squaws. There was usually carnage, inhibited mainly by the water the traders had added to the whiskey. At the Green River Rendezvous, however, Smith and two of his partners, David Jackson and William Sublette, forsook the festivities for serious business. They had decided to take over the Missouri Fur Trading Company from its owner, General William Ashley, who had amassed a substantial fortune in an astonishingly short time. When the deal was consummated, Smith was given the assignment he coveted, to be in charge of finding new sources of pelts. Within days of returning from Oregon, Smith was already heading out with a party of 14 men from Cache Valley, Utah, in search of virgin beaver streams. They followed the languid Sevier River through the red and blonde deserts of southwestern Utah, then jumped across to the Virgin River, which led them to the Colorado above the present site of Hoover Dam. Unknowingly, they were breaking the Mormon Outlet Trail, by which the secrets of successful irrigation would migrate to California and Arizona and be applied with such ambition that, within a scant century and a half, there would be proposals to import irrigation water from Alaska along the same route. By the time they reached the Colorado River, winter was already near. They had trapped only a few beaver and didn't feel like turning back. Anxious to find warmth and food, Smith decided to lead the party across the Mojave Desert toward the ocean coast. A complete barrens, was his description, a country of starvation. After several exhausting days, they had to carry all their water. The explorers sighted two tall ranges to the west. They crossed the pass between them and found themselves in the Los Angeles Basin at Mission San Gabriel Archangel in Spanish California. The Padres' reception was friendly, but the Spanish governor's was not. Ever since hearing about the expedition of Capitan Meriwether, his attitude toward Yankees had tilted toward paranoia. Exiled from the basin, Smith led his party up the San Joaquin Valley and into the Sierra Nevada, where, along the Stanislaus River, they found beaver in urban concentrations. After a few weeks of trapping, Smith loaded hundreds of plews on horses, selected his two toughest men, and set off across the spine of the Sierra Nevada into what is now Nevada. Of all the routes across the Great Basin, the one he chose is the longest and driest. U.S. Highway 6 now runs parallel and slightly south. The trip is so desolate and frightening that many motorists will not take it. Even in an air-conditioned car loaded with water jugs, they go north along Interstate 80, which stays reassuringly in sight of the Humboldt River. In 600 miles of travel, Smith's party crossed three small, inconstant streams. That they survived at all is a miracle. My arrival caused a considerable bustle in camp, he wrote in his diary, after arriving in time for the second rendezvous on the Bear River in Utah. A small cannon, brought up from St. Louis, was loaded and fired for a salute. Myself and party had been given up for lost. 2 weeks after the rendezvous, Smith was, incredibly, on the way to California again, anxious to relieve the men who had remained on the Stanislaus and to trap out the beaver of the Sierra Nevada before someone else discovered them. His route was pretty much the same as the time before. While crossing the Colorado, however, his party was ambushed by a band of Mojave Indians. 9 of the 19 men survived, among them Smith. Fleeing across a desert, they finally reached Southern California, where Smith left 3 wounded men to recover. The rest of the party then joined the trappers they had left the year before. How they managed to find each other is a subject Smith passes over lightly in his diary. Both groups, by now, were bereft of supplies. Selecting his 2 friendliest surviving men, Smith rode across the Central Valley to the missions at Santa Clara and San Jose to barter plews for food, medicine, clothing, and ammunition. As soon as the members of the party were sighted, they were dragged off to jail in Monterey. Bail was set at $30,000, an amount calculated to ensure that they would remain there at the governor's whim. Smith's luck, however, seemed to ricochet between the abominable and sublime. A wealthy sea captain from New England, who was holding over in Monterey, was so impressed by Smith's courage that he arranged to post the entire amount. Freed but banished forever from California, Smith gathered the remnants of his expedition, and they wandered up the Sacramento Valley, trapping as they went. It was by then the middle of winter, and the snowpack in the Sierra was 12 feet deep. Crossing the range was out of the question. Smith decided to venture back toward the ocean. Crossing the Yalabali and Trinity Mountains, the party found itself in a rainforest dominated by a gigantic species of conifer they had never seen. Reaching the Pacific near the mouth of the river that now bears Smith's name, they slogged northward through country which can receive 100 inches of rain during 6 winter months. At the mouth of the Umpqua River, they stopped to rest. Smith went off to reconnoiter in an improvised canoe. While he was gone, a band of the Umpqua tribe stole into camp and murdered all but 3 of the men. Fleeing through the tangled forest beneath giant trees, 2 of the survivors found Smith, and they raced off together in the direction of Fort Vancouver on the Columbia River. They arrived there in August of 1828, emaciated and in shock. Their last surviving companion straggled in after them. He had found his way alone. The British, by then well established in Oregon, considered the attack ominous enough to demand a reprisal. An expedition was dispatched from the Umpqua Valley, where the marauding band was cornered. 39 horses and Smith's 700 beaver pelts were seized. Although the British were still smarting from the War of 1812, the commander refused to let Smith compensate him for his trouble. Instead, he paid him $3,200 for the horses and pelts. He also offered the Americans a long rest at the fort, since it would take most of the winter for them to tell all their tales. In the spring of 1829, the assembled force of Fort Vancouver watched in disbelief as Smith and Arthur Black, the last of the 4 survivors who still retained their nerve, strode confidently through the gates and up the Columbia River, en route to the June rendezvous. They are sporting with life or counting danger to madness, remarked the commander, who never went out with fewer than 40 men. Within 12 weeks, Smith and Black were back among their companions in Jackson Hole. After 6 years of hair-raising adventures, Jedediah Smith decided to relax and devote a season to tranquil pursuits, trapping beaver on icy mountain streams in territory claimed by Indians and grizzly bears, and then returned to St. Louis to see what opportunity lay there. But civilization stank in his nostrils, and wilderness coursed through his blood. After a brief stay in the frontier capital, Smith was back on the Santa Fe Trail, guiding pioneers westward. It was there, at the age of 30, that his life came to an abrupt end, a Comanche tomahawk embedded in his skull. He is memorialized today across a region the size of Europe, though modern explorers in a Prowler or a Winnebago may not realize that half a dozen Smith Rivers and a landscape of Smith Parks, passes, peaks, and valleys in 11 states are mostly named after the same Smith. The useful role ascribed to the mountain men is that they opened the door to settlement of the West. It might be more accurate, however, to say that they slammed it shut. The terrors they endured were hardly apt to draw settlers, and their written accounts of the region had to lie heavy on a settler's mind. Plains so arid that they could barely support bunch grass, deserts that were fiercely hot and fiercely cold, streams that flooded a few weeks each year and went dry the rest, forests with trees so large it might take days to bring one down, Indians, grizzly bears, wolves, and grasshopper plagues, hail followed by drought, followed by hail, no gold. You could live off the land in better years, but the life of a trapper, a hunter, a fortune-seeker, the only type of life that seemed possible in the West, was not what the vast majority of Americans sought. There were those who believed, in the 1830s, that the Louisiana Purchase had been a waste of $15 million, that the whole 1 billion acres would remain as empty as Mongolia or the Sahara. And then, just a generation later, there were those who believed 1 billion people were destined to settle there. It seemed there was only one person in the whole United States with the wisdom, the scientific detachment, and the explorer's insight to dissect both myths and find the truth that lay buried within. John Wesley Powell belonged to a subspecies of American which flourished briefly during the 19th century and went extinct with the end of the frontier. It was an estimable company, one that included the likes of Mark Twain, John Muir, Abraham Lincoln, William Dean Howells, and Hamilton Garland. They were genuine Renaissance men, though their circumstances were vastly different from those of Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin. The founding fathers, the most notable among them, were urban gentlemen or gentleman farmers who grew up in a society that, though it sought to keep Europe and its mannerisms at arm's length, had a fair amount in common with the old world. They lived in very civilized style, even if they lived at the edge of a frontier. Powell, Howells, Lincoln, and the others were children of the real frontier. Most grew up on subsistence farms hacked out of ancient forests or grafted onto tall grass prairie. They lacked formal education, breeding, and refinement. Schooled by teachers who knew barely more than they did, chained to the rigors of farm life, they got their education from borrowed books, devoured by the embers of a fireplace, or surreptitiously smuggled into the fields. What they lacked in worldliness and schooling, however, they more than made up in vitality, originality, and circumambient intelligence. John Wesley Powell may be one of the lesser known of this group, but he stood alone in the variety of his interests and the indefatigability of his pursuits. Powell's father was a poor itinerant preacher who transplanted his family westward behind the breaking wave of the frontier. As a boy in the 1840s, Powell moved from Chillicothe, Ohio, to Walworth County, Wisconsin, to Bonus Prairie, Illinois. Nothing was paved, little was fenced, The forests were full of cougars and the streams full of fish. To Powell, the frontier was a rapturous experience. Like John Muir, he got a vagabond's education, rambling cross-country in order to become intimate with forests and fauna, with hydrology and weather. In the summer of 1855, Powell struck out for 4 months and walked across Wisconsin. 2 years later, he floated down the Ohio River from Pittsburgh to St. Louis. A few months later, he was gathering fossils in interior Missouri. The next spring, he was rowing alone down the Illinois River and up the Mississippi and the Des Moines River to the middle of Iowa, then a wilderness. Between his peregrinations, Powell picked up some frantic education, Greek, Latin, botany, a bit of philosophy, at Wheaton, Oberlin, and Illinois College, but he never graduated and he never stayed long. Powell learned on the run. When the Civil War broke out, Powell enlisted on the Union side, fought bravely, and came out a major, a confidant of Ulysses Grant, and minus an arm, which was removed by a steel ball at the Battle of Shiloh. To Powell, the loss of an arm was merely a nuisance, though the raw nerve endings in his amputated stump kept him in pain for the rest of his life. After the war, he tried a stint at teaching, first at Illinois Wesleyan and then at Illinois State, but it didn't satisfy him. He helped found the Illinois Museum of Natural History and was an obvious candidate for the position of curator, but decided that this, too, was too dull an avenue with too visible an end. Powell, like the mountain men, was compulsively drawn to the frontier. In the United States of the late 1860s, there was but one place where the frontier was still nearly intact. By 1869, the population of New York City had surpassed 1 million. The city had built a great water supply aqueduct to the Croton River and was imagining its future subway system. Chicago, founded 30 years earlier, was already a big sprawling industrial town. The millionaires of San Francisco were building their palatial mansions on Nob Hill. New England was deforested. Farms and settlements were spilling onto the prairie. However, on maps of the United States published in that year, a substantial area remained a complete blank and was marked unexplored. The region overlay parts of what is now Colorado, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and Nevada. It was about the size of France, and through the middle of it ran the Colorado River. That was about all that was known about it, except that the topography was awesome and the rainfall scarce. The region was known as the Plateau Province, and parties heading westward tended to avoid it at all costs. Some of the Franciscan friars, who were as tough as anyone in the Old West, had wandered through it on the old Spanish trail. Otherwise, the Mormon Outlet Trail skirted the region to the west, the California and Oregon Trail swung northward, and the El Paso-Yuma Trail went south. From a distance, one could see multicolored and multi-storied mesas and cliffs, saurian ridges, and occasionally a distant snow-capped peak. There were accounts of canyons that began without reason and were suddenly 1,000 feet deep, eroded more by wind than by water. A distance that a bird could cover in an hour might require a week to negotiate. The days were hot, and the nights were often frigid, owing to the region's higher interior vastness, and the water was almost impossible to find. Lacking wings, there was only one good way to explore it, by boat. On the 24th of May, 1869, the Powell Geographic Expedition set out on the Green River from the town of Green River, Wyoming, in 4 wooden dories, the Maid of the Canyon, the Kitty Clyde Sister, the Emma Dean, and the No Name. For a scientific expedition, it was an odd group. Powell, the leader, was the closest thing to a scientist. He had brought along his brother Walter, moody, sarcastic, morose, one of the thousands of psychiatric casualties of the Civil War. The rest of the party was made up mostly of mountain men. O.G. Howland, his brother Seneca, Bill Dunn, Billy Hawkins, and Jack Sumner, all of whom had been collected by Powell en route to Green River. He had also invited a beat-faced Englishman named Frank Goodman, who had been patrolling the frontier towns looking for adventure, and Andy Hall, an 18-year-old roustabout whose casual skill as an oarsman had impressed Powell when he saw him playing with a boat on the Green River. There was also George Bradley, a tough guy whom Powell had met by accident at Fort Bridger and who had agreed to come along in exchange for a discharge from the army, which Powell managed to obtain for him. For 60 miles out of the town of Green River, the river was sandy-bottomed and amiable. There were riffles, but nothing that could legitimately be called a rapid. The boatmen played in the currents, acquiring a feel for moving water. The others admired the scenery. As they neared the Uinta Mountains, they went into a sandstone canyon colored in marvelous hues, which Powell, who had a knack for naming things, called Flaming Gorge. The river bore southward until it came up against the flanks of the range, then turned eastward and entered Red Canyon. In Red Canyon, the expedition got its first lesson in how a few feet of drop per mile can turn a quiet river into something startling. Several of the rapids frightened them into racing for shore and lining or portaging, an awful strain with several thousand pounds of boats, supplies, and gear. After a while, however, even the bigger rapids were not so menacing anymore, if, compared to what was about to come, one could call them big. Beyond Flaming Gorge, the landscape opened up into Brown's Park. But soon the river gathered imperceptible momentum, and the canyon ramparts closed around them like a pair of jaws. A maelstrom followed. Huge, scissoring waves leaped between naked boulders. The river plunged into devouring holes. The awestruck Andy Hall recited an alliterative verse he had learned as a Scottish schoolboy, The Cataract of Lodore, by the English romantic poet Robert Southey. Over Powell's objection, he did not like using a European name. The stretch became the Canyon of Lodore. As they approached the first big rapid in the canyon, the known name was sucked in by the accelerating current before anyone had a chance to scout. "I pass around a great crag just in time to see the boat strike a rock, and rebounding from the shock, careen and fill the open compartment with water," wrote Powell in his serialized journal of the trip. "Two of the men lost their oars. She swings around, and is carried down at a rapid rate broadside on for quite a few yards, and strikes amidships on another rock with great force, is broken quite in two, and then men are thrown into the river, the larger part of the boat floating buoyantly. They soon seize it, and down the river they drift for a few hundred yards to a second rapid filled with huge boulders, where the boat strikes again and is dashed to pieces, and the men and fragments are soon carried beyond my sight." The three crew members survived, but most of the extra clothes, the barometers, and several weeks' worth of food were gone. The next day, the party found the stern of the boat intact, still holding the barometers, some flour, and a barrel of whiskey that Powell, who was something of a prig, did not realize had been smuggled aboard. When they finally floated out of Lodore Canyon into the sunlit beauty of Echo Park, Powell wrote in his journal that despite a chapter of disaster and toil, the Canyon of Lodore was not devoid of scenic interest, even beyond the power of the pen to tell. And O.G. Howland, who nearly lost his life in Disaster Falls, wrote haughtily that a calm, smooth stream is a horror we all detest now. Desolation Canyon, Gray Canyon. They were now in territory even Indians hadn't seen. The landscape closed in and opened up. Labyrinth Canyon, Stillwater Canyon. They shot a buck and scared a bighorn lamb off a cliff, their first fresh meat in weeks. Powell, climbing a cliff with his one arm, got himself rimmed and required rescue by Bradley, who got above him, dangled his long johns, and pulled Powell up. the country grew drier and more desolate. Fantastic mesas loomed in the distance, banded like shells. The Grand Mesa to the east, the largest mesa in the world, rose to 11,000 feet from desert bandlands into an alpine landscape of forests and lakes. Wind-eroded shiprocks loomed over the rubblized beds of prehistoric seas. Battlements of sandstone rose in the distance like ruins of empire. Deep in uncharted territory, the Colorado River, then known as the Grand, rushed in quietly from the northeast, carrying the snowmelt of Long's Peak and most of western Colorado. The river's volume had now doubled, but still it remained quite placid. Was it conceivable that they were near the end of its run? Powell was tempted to believe so, but knew better. There were 4,000 feet of elevation loss ahead. On the 21st, after a short stop to rest and reseal the boats, they were on the water again, which was high, roiled, and the color of cocoa. In a few miles they came to a canyon, frothing with rapids. They lined or portaged wherever they could, ran if they had no alternative. Soon they were between vertical walls, and the river was roaring mud. Cataracts launched them downriver before they had time to think. Waves like mud huts threw them 8 feet into the air. The scouts would venture ahead if there was room enough to walk, and return ashen-faced. The canyon relented a little at times, so they could portage, but the river did not. In one day, they made 3/4 of a mile in Cataract Canyon, portaging everything they saw. During the daytime, the temperature would reach 106 degrees. At night, the men shivered in their dank drawers. Some became edgy, prone to violent outbursts. Bradley's incendiary moods lasted through most of a day, and he would run almost anything rather than portage. Powell's instinctive caution infuriated Bradley, as did his indefatigable specimen gathering, surveying, and consignment of everything to notes. The pace was maddeningly uneven. They would do 8 miles in a day, then a mere mile or two. 2 months' worth of food remained, most of it musty bread, dried apples, spoiled bacon, and coffee. Once, Billy Hawkins got up in the middle of dinner, walked to the boats, and pulled out the sextant. He said he was trying to find the latitude and longitude of the nearest pie. On the 23rd of July, they passed a foul-smelling little stream coming in from the west. They called it the Dirty Devil. The big river quieted. The hunters took off up the cliffsides and returned with a couple of desert bighorn sheep, which were devoured with sybaritic abandon. The sheep were an omen. For the next several days, they floated on a brisk but serene river through a canyon such as no one had seen. Instead of the pitiless angular black-burned walls of Cataract Canyon, they were now enveloped by rounded pink and salmon-colored sandstone, undulating ahead of them in soft contours. There were huge arched chasms, Arcadian glens hung with maidenhair ferns, zebra-striped walls, opalescent green fractures irrigated by secret springs. Groping for a name that would properly convey their sense of both awe and relief, Powell decided on Glen Canyon. On August 1st and 2nd, the party camped in Music Temple. By the 5th of August, they were down to 15 pounds of rancid bacon, several bags of matted flour, a small store of dried apples, and a large quantity of coffee. Other than that, they would have to try to live off the land. But the land was mostly vertical, and the game, which had never been plentiful, had all but disappeared. They met the Escalante River, draining unknown territory in Utah, then the San Juan, carrying in snow melt from southwestern Colorado. The river on which they were floating was made up now of most of the mentionable runoff of the far southwest. They were in country that no white person had ever seen, riding the runoff of a region the size of Iraq, and they approached each blind bend in the river with a mixture of anticipation and terror. Soon the soft sandstone of Glen Canyon was replaced by the fabulous coloration of Marble Canyon. Then, on August 14th, the hard black rock of Cataract Canyon reemerged from the crust of the earth. "The river enters the gneiss," wrote Powell. Downriver, they heard what sounded like an avalanche. Soap Creek Rapids, Badger Creek Rapids, Crystal Creek Rapids, Lava Falls. Nearly all of the time, the creeks that plunge down the ravines of the Grand Canyon will barely float a walnut shell. But the flash floods resulting from a desert downpour can dislodge boulders as big as a jitney bus. Tumbled by gravity, the boulders carom into the main river and sit there, creating a dam, which doesn't so much stop the river as make it mad. Except for the rapids of the Susitna, the Niagara, and perhaps a couple of rivers in Canada, the modern Colorado's rapids are the biggest on the continent. Before the dams were built, however, the Colorado's rapids were really big. At Lava Falls, where huge chunks of basalt dumped in the main river created a 30-foot drop, waves at flood stage were as high as three-story houses. There was a cycling wave at the bottom that, every few seconds, would burst apart with the retort of a 16-inch gun, drenching anyone on either bank of the river, 200 feet apart. To run Lava Falls today, in a 30-foot Hypalon raft, wrapped in a Mae West life jacket, vaguely secure in the knowledge that a rescue helicopter sits on the canyon rim, is a lesson in panic. The Powell expedition was running most of the canyon's rapids in a 15-foot pilot boat made of pine and a couple of 21-foot dories made of oak, with the rudest of life jackets, without hope of rescue, without a single human being within hundreds of miles. And Powell himself was running them strapped to a captain's chair, gesticulating wildly with his one arm. The river twisted madly. It swung north, then headed south, then back north, then east, east, then back south. Even Powell, constantly consulting sextant and compass, felt flummoxed. The rapids, meanwhile, had grown so powerful that the boats received a terrible battering from the force of the waves alone and had to be recalked every day. As they ran out of food and out of caulk, Powell realized that the men were also beginning to run out of will. There was mutiny in their whisperings. August 25th. They had come 35 miles, including a portage around a spellbinding rapid where a boulder dam of hardened lava turned the river into the aftermath of Vesuvius. That, as it turned out, had been Lava Falls. There were still no Grand Wash cliffs, which would signal the confluence with the Virgin River and the end of their ordeal. They saw, for the first time in weeks, some traces of Indian habitation, but obviously no one had lived there in years. Occasionally they caught a glimpse of trees on the canyon rim, 5,000 feet above. They were in the deepest canyon any of them had ever seen. August 26th. They came on an Indian garden full of fresh squash. With starvation imminent, they stole a dozen gourds and ate them ravenously. "We are 3/4 of a mile into depths of the earth," wrote Powell, "and the great river shrinks into insignificance as it dashes its angry waves against the walls and cliffs that rise to the world above. They are but puny ripples and we but pygmies running up and down the sands or lost among the boulders. But," he added hopefully, "a few more days like this and we are out of prison." August 27th. The river, which had been tending toward the west, veered again toward the south. The hated Precambrian granite, which had dropped below the riverbed, surfaced again. Immediately came a rapid which they decided to portage. At 11 o'clock in the morning, they came to the worst rapids yet. "The billows are huge," wrote Bradley. "The spectacle is appalling." It was, Jack Sumner wrote, "a hell of foam." The rapids were bookended by cliffs. There was no way to portage and no way to line. There wasn't even a decent way to scout. After the party had had a meal of fried flour patties and coffee, O.G. Howland asked Powell to go for a walk with him. The major knew what was coming. It saddened him that if there was to be a mutiny, the leader would be Howland. He was a mountain man by nature and experience, but after Powell, still the most literate and scientific-minded of the group. Nonetheless, Howland had been plagued by bad luck. It was he who had steered the No-Name to its destruction in Lodore Canyon, he who had twice lost maps and notes in swampings. He had tested fate enough. In the morning, Howland told Powell, he and his brother Seneca, together with Bill Dunn, were going to abandon the boats and climb out of the canyon. Powell did not sleep that night. He took reading after reading with his sextant, until he was as positive as he dared be that they were within 50 miles of Grand Wash Cliffs. At the most, they ought to be 4 days from civilization, with the only remaining obstacle in view a wild 20-second ride through a terrific rapid. Powell woke Howland in the middle of the night and poured out his conviction, but it was too late. His immediate reaction was 2 laconic sentences in his journal, but later he offered this version of what took place. "We have another short talk about the morrow, but for me there is no sleep. All night long I pace up and down a little path, on a few yards of sand beach, along by the river. Is it wise to go on? I go to the boats again to look at our rations. I feel satisfied that we can get over the danger immediately before us. What there may be below, I know not." From our outlook yesterday, on the cliffs, the canyon seemed to make another great bend to the south, and this, from our experience heretofore, means more and higher granite walls. I am not sure that we can climb out of the canyon here, and when at the top of the wall, I know enough of the country to be certain that it is a desert of rock and sand between this and the nearest Mormon town, which, on the most direct line, must be 75 miles away. True, the last rains have been favorable to us, should we go out, for the probabilities are that we shall find water still standing in holes, and at one time I almost conclude to leave the river. But for years I have been contemplating this trip, to leave the exploration unfinished, to say that there is a part of the canyon which I cannot explore, having already almost accomplished it, is more than I am willing to acknowledge, and I determine to go on. August 28th. Breakfast was as solemn as a funeral. Afterward, Powell asked all of the men, for the last time, whether they planned to go ahead or climb out. The Howlands and Bill Dunn still intended to walk out. The rest would remain. The party gave the three some guns and offered them their equal share of the remaining rations. They accepted the guns. "Some tears are shed," Powell wrote. "It is rather a solemn parting. Each party thinks the other is taking the dangerous course." Billy Hawkins stole away and laid some biscuits on a rock the mutineers would pass on their way up the cliffs. "They are as fine fellows as I ever had the good fortune to meet," declared taciturn George Bradley, blinking away a tear. As the others rowed cautiously toward the monster rapids in their two boats, the Howland brothers and Bill Dunn had already begun climbing up one of the canyon arroyos. Powell felt himself torn between watching them and the approaching rapids. They plunged down the first drop. The hydraulic wave at the bottom inundated them, but the water was so swift that they were out of it before the boat could fill. They were launched atop a pillow of water covering a rock, slid off, then rowed out a landscape of haystacks. As the maid of the canyon circulated quietly in the whirlpool at Rapids End, Kitty Clyde's sister wallowed up alongside. The roar of the rapids was almost submerged by the men's ecstatic shouts. They grabbed rifles and fired volley after volley into the air to show their erstwhile companions that it could be done. Unable to see around the bend in the river or to walk back up, they waited in the eddy for nearly 2 hours, hoping the others would rejoin them, but they never did. A few miles below Separation Rapid, the party came to another rapid, Lava Cliffs, which, were it not now under the waters of Lake Mead, would perhaps be the biggest on the river. In a style so much like the man himself, exact and fastidious, yet felicitous and engaging, Powell wrote down what happened there. On the northern side of the canyon is a bold escarpment that seems to be 100 feet high. We can climb it and walk along its summit to a point where we are just at the head of the fall. Here the basalt is broken down again, so it seems to us, and I direct the men to take a line to the top of the cliff and let the boats down along the wall. One man remains in the boat to keep her clear of the rocks and prevent her line from being caught on the projecting angles. I climb the cliff and pass along to a point just over the fall and descend by broken rocks and find that the break of the fall is above the break of the wall, so that we cannot land, and that still below the river is very bad, and that there is no possibility of a portage. Without waiting further to examine and determine what shall be done, I hasten back to the top of the cliff to stop the boats from coming down. When I arrive, I find the men have let one of them down to the head of the fall. She is in swift water, and they are not able to pull her back, nor are they able to go on with the line, as it is not long enough to reach the higher part of the cliff which is just before them. So they take a bite around a crag. I send two men back for the other line. The boat is in very swift water, and Bradley is standing in the open compartment, holding out his oar to prevent her from striking against the foot of the cliff. Now she shoots out into the stream and up as far as the line will permit, and then, wheeling, drives headlong against the rock, and then out and back again, now straining on the line, now striking against the rock. As soon as the second line is brought, we pass it down to him. But his attention is all taken up with his own situation, and he does not see that we are passing him the line. I stand on a projecting rock, waving my hat to gain his attention, for my voice is drowned by the roaring of the falls. Just at this moment, I see him take his knife from its sheath and step forward to cut the line. He has evidently decided that it is better to go over with the boat as it is than to wait for her to be broken to pieces. As he leans over, the boat sheers again into the stream. The stem post breaks away and she is loose. With perfect composure, Bradley seizes the great scull oar, places it in the stern rowlock, and pulls with all his power, and he is an athlete, to turn the bow of the boat downstream, for he wishes to go bow down rather than to drift broadside on. One, two strokes he makes, and a third just as she goes over, and the boat is fairly turned and she goes down almost beyond our sight, though we are more than 100 feet above the river. Then she comes up again on a great wave, and down and up, then around behind some great rocks and is lost in the mad white foam below. We stand frozen with fear, for we see no boat. Bradley is gone, so it seems. But now, away below, we see something coming out of the waves. It is evidently a boat. A moment more, and we see Bradley standing on deck, swinging his hat to show that he is all right. But he is in a whirlpool. We have the stem post of his boat attached to the line. How badly she may be disabled, we know not. I direct Sumner and Walter Powell to pass along the cliff and see if they can reach him from below. Hawkins, Hall, and myself run to the other boat, jump aboard, push out, and away we go over the falls. A wave rolls over us, and our boat is unmanageable. Another great wave strikes us, and the boat rolls over and tumbles and tosses, I know not how. All I know is that Bradley is picking us up. We soon have all right again, and row to the cliff and wait until Sumner and Powell can come. After a difficult climb, they reach us. We run 2 or 3 miles farther, and turn again to the northwest, continuing until night, when we have run out of the granite once more. August 30th. At the confluence of the Colorado and the Virgin River, 3 Mormons and an Indian helper are seine-netting fish. They have been there for weeks, under orders from Brigham Young to watch for the Powell expedition. Since the members of the expedition have already been reported dead several times in the newspapers, the Mormons are really on the lookout for corpses and wreckage. They hope to salvage whatever journals and maps have survived in order that they might learn something about the unexplored portion of the region where they have banished themselves. Late in the morning, one of them flings a glance upriver and freezes. There are two boats coming down, and, unless they are ghosts, the people inside them seem to be alive. It had taken 3 months and 6 days for the expedition to travel from Green River to Grand Wash Cliffs. Though wilder water than the Colorado is routinely run today, few river runners would dispute that the Powell expedition accomplished the most impressive feat of perilous river exploration in history. But the expedition ended, as fate would have it, on an ironically tragic note. While Powell and those who stayed with him were being fed and pumped for information by the Mormons, the Howland brothers and Bill Dunn were lying dead on the rim of the Grand Canyon, murdered by a band of Shi'vwits Indians. Later, there were rumors that they had molested a Shi'vwits girl. But the Indian wars were raging, and they may have been killed simply for taking the band by surprise. That the Shi'vwits shot Powell's companions full of holes contains a cold irony, for years later, after Powell had sat around many campfires with them, the Shi'vwits tribe would come to regard the one-armed major as their most faithful white friend. When John Wesley Powell first left Council Bluffs, Iowa in 1867, bound for Denver in the valley of the Green River, the region he crossed was virtually empty. It was like modern interior Alaska after removing Fairbanks. Indians were more common than whites, and buffalo were much more prevalent than Indians. By the time he reached the 98th meridian, about two-fifths of the way across Nebraska, the light dusting of settlers' towns and farms had thinned out to nothing. Before him were another 500 miles of virgin plains, almost uninhabited by whites. Then there was Denver, a rowdy little town that owed its existence mainly to furs and gold, and not much else until one got to Salt Lake and California. On each successive trip west, the changes took away Powell's breath. The breaking wave of settlement was eating up half a meridian a year. From one season to the next, settlements were 30 miles further out. By the late 1870s, the 100th meridian had been fatefully crossed. There were homes sprouting in central Nebraska, miles from water, trees, and neighbors, their occupants living in sod dugouts suggestive of termite mounds. Farms began to grow up around Denver, where a type of agriculture thoroughly alien to America's farmers, irrigation, was being experimented with. Horace Greeley, the publisher of the New York Herald Tribune, the publisher whose words, "Go West, young man," galvanized the 19th century, was mainly responsible for this. He had dispatched his agricultural editor, Nathan Meeker, to a spot north of Denver to found a utopian irrigation colony which, not surprisingly, became Greeley, Colorado. The colony appeared to be a success, even forgetting the large annual contribution from Greeley. On their way across the plains, travelers could see huge rolling clouds of dust on the southern horizon, caused by cattle drives from Texas to railheads at Dodge and Kansas City. The plains were being dug up. The buffalo were being annihilated to starve the Indians and make way for cows. The vanishing tribes were being herded like cattle onto reservations. This enormous gush of humanity pouring into a region still marked on some maps as the Great American Desert was encouraged by wishful thinking, by salesmanship, that most American of motivating forces, and most of all, by natural caprice. For a number of years after 1865, a long humid cycle brought uninterrupted, above-average rainfall to the plains. Guides leading wagon trains to Oregon reported that western Nebraska, usually blonde from drought or black from prairie fires, had turned opalescent green. Late in the 1870s, the boundary of the Great American Desert appeared to have retreated westward across the Rockies to the threshold of the Great Basin. such a spectacular climatic transformation was not about to be dismissed as a fluke, not by a people who thought themselves handpicked by God to occupy a wild continent. A new school of meteorology was founded to explain it. Its unspoken principle was divine intervention, and its motto was, "Rain follows the plow." Since the rains coincided with the headlong westward advance of settlement, the two must somehow be related. Professor Cyrus Thomas, a noted climatologist, was a leading proponent. "Since the territory of Colorado has begun to be settled," he announced in declamatory tones, "towns and cities built up, farms cultivated, mines opened, and roads made and traveled, there has been a gradual increase in moisture. I therefore give it as my firm conviction that this increase is of a permanent nature and not periodical, and that it has commenced within 8 years past, and that it is in some way connected to the settlement of the country, and that as population increases, the moisture will increase." Ferdinand V. Hayden, who was Thomas's boss and one of the most famous geographers and geologists of his time, also subscribed to the theory. Hayden happened to be a notable rival of John Wesley Powell, who believed otherwise. The exact explanations varied. Plowing the land exposed the soil's moisture to the sky. Newly planted trees enhanced rainfall. The smoke from trains caused it. Vibrations in the air created by all the commotion helped clouds to form. Dynamiting the air became a popular means of inducing rain to fall. Even the Secretary of Agriculture came out for a demonstration in Texas. The result, he reported, was a loud noise. The notion that settlement was changing the climate on the flat, loamy, treeless plains rang irresistibly true to the subsistence farmer from the east who spent more time clearing his land of rocks and stumps than plowing and harvesting. Hamlin Garland, the writer, was the son of such a subsistence farmer, a man hounded out of Wisconsin by trees and hills. "More and more," Garland was to remember, "my father resented the stumps and ridges which interrupted his plow. Much of his quarter section remained unbroken. There were ditches to be dug and young oaks to be uprooted in the forest. Bitterly he resented his up-tilted, horse-killing fields, and his complaining words sank so deep in the minds of his son that for years thereafter they were unable to look upon any rise of ground as an object to be admired." The Irish potato famine, a bad drought in the Ohio Valley, the reflexive restlessness which, Alex de Tocqueville thought, set Americans apart from the Europeans they had recently been, all of these, too, were behind the flood. When Hamlin Garland's family settled in Iowa, they had no neighbors within sight. A year later, they were surrounded, fence post to fence post. "All the wild things died or hurried away, never to return," wrote Garland mournfully. "The tender plants, the sweet flowers, the fragrant fruits, the busy insects, prairie wolves that lurked in the grass and swales, all of the swarming lives which had been native here for countless centuries were utterly destroyed. If poor immigrants arrived in Iowa and found land too expensive, they could either return east and look for some hardscrabble farm they could afford, in West Virginia perhaps, or New Hampshire, or continue on to Nebraska. Since rain was bound to follow the plow, they went to Nebraska. Merchants in St. Louis and other railhead cities, who dreamed of markets expanding in three directions at once, became cheerleaders for the new meteorology. So did land speculators, who figured that even if it was nonsense, they could buy out the burned-out homesteaders for a pittance and convert their farms to rangeland. But nothing did away with the great American desert quite as effectively as the railroads." In 1867, the Kansas Pacific did not reach the Pacific. Few of the railroads which veiled themselves in oceanic mists ever did. But it did reach as far as Abilene, Kansas. The Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad was already to La Junta, Colorado, and branching south to Santa Fe. The Union Pacific made Cheyenne, and 2 years later it met the Central Pacific at Promontory, Utah, spanning the continent. The Southern Pacific linked Texas to San Francisco. The Northern Pacific hitched Montana to Duluth. The initial result of such unparalleled expansion was an ocean of debt. The federal government had arranged the loans, but what was a loan worth if you didn't see how you could raise the income to pay it back? Of course, there was a way for the government to help with that problem. After all, it did own plenty of land. During the 4 decades following the Civil War, 183 million acres went out of the public domain into railroad ownership. To call it a bonanza is to understate the matter significantly. The railroad land grants were a gift the size of California plus the major part of Montana. The deeded lands usually paralleled the railroad's track. Reproduced on maps, they resembled jet streams flowing in reverse. Anyone who bought land from the railroads would be utterly dependent on them for getting his harvests to eastern markets and receiving supplies in return. When the time came to set rates, the railroads could charge pretty much what they pleased. But first, they had to seduce the settlers who were still content to battle stumps in Kentucky or endure peonage in Germany and Ireland. J.J. Hill, the founder of the Great Northern, said as much himself. "You can lay track through the Garden of Eden," he told an acquaintance, "but why bother if the only inhabitants are Adam and Eve?" The upswing in precipitation and the crypto-science that explained it were exactly what was needed. From there, it became a job for advertising. The creative juices flowed. A publicist working for the Rio Grande and Western Railroad noticed, while gazing at a map of the territory of Deseret, now Utah, a faint resemblance to the cradle of civilization. The Rio Grande and Western promptly published a map of Deseret that contained an inset map of Palestine, the Promised Land, calling attention to their striking similarity. "Follow Prairie Dogs and Mormons," went a pamphlet of the Burlington Line, "and you will find good land." It failed to mention that prairie dogs, which build their homes underground, cannot do so in wet or soggy ground, and therefore loathe any place receiving a decent amount of rain. A Northern Pacific circular proclaimed, with no evident sense of shame, that not a single case of illness had been recorded in Montana during the previous year, except for indigestion caused by overeating. Many of the railroads published their own newspapers, full of so-called testimonials from alleged Kansas farmers who were raising 100 bushels of corn to the acre, from settlers who had traded rags for riches in 5 years. "Why emigrate to Kansas?" asked a testimonial in Western Trail, the Rock Island Railroad's Gazette. "Because it is the garden spot of the world, because it will grow anything that any other country will grow, and with less work. Because it rains here more than in any other place, and at just the right time." The railroads were careful to conceal their ties with the land sale companies they owned, and with the journalists to whom they gave free passage and free meals, if not paychecks. One such journalist, Frederick Goddard, produced a popular publication entitled "Where to Emigrate and Why." "The Laramie Plains of Wyoming," he said, "were a good place, as ready today for the plow and spade as the fertile prairies of Illinois." The Laramie Plains are 5,000 feet higher than Illinois. The growing season is at least 50 days shorter. There is about a third as much rain. Western Nebraska was also a delight. A few patches of drift sand, perhaps, but calling it a desert was preposterous. By drift sand, Goddard may have meant the sand hills, a 15,000-square-mile expanse of thirsty dunes which, to this day, remains mostly uninhabited and unfarmed. "The utmost care has been exercised to admit nothing that cannot be depended upon as correct. All claims may be fully sustained upon investigation. If hard work doesn't agree with you, or you can't get on without luxuries, stay where you are. If you don't have enough capital to equip and stock a farm, if you are susceptible to homesickness, if you do not have pluck and perseverance, stay where you are." At a time when a 5-course dinner in a fancy restaurant cost $1.25. The Union Pacific and the Burlington spent $1 million on advertising for Nebraska alone. Even so, sooner